For our blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service provides the following program. It's the North Carolina Reading Service's presentation of Indie Week, and I'm John Federson here to read it for you. The edition is a Dateline, our broadcast anyway, comes out on March the 1st of 2024. I'm reading this on Leap Day, the day prior. And there are very many Leap Day related things going on, but since it already happened yesterday, as far as you're concerned, I'm going to skip over them and we'll get right into this issue of Indie Week. Our first article is titled Striving for Zero, the struggle to end pedestrian deaths in the Triangle. One November evening in Chapel Hill, Sinclair Larson's life changed forever when she was struck by a car on a Franklin Street crosswalk while walking her dog, Jasper. Larson and her dog were lucky enough to survive, although she doesn't remember the collision. She doesn't even recall leaving to go on the walk, the result of a significant brain injury. However, a comment the nurses made to Larson after she woke up at UNC Medical Center still sticks with her today, 3 years after she was hit. She said, "The nurses were like, 'Oh yeah, we get people that were hit on crosswalks all the time here.' And I was like, 'All the time? Like, that's a problem.'" Larson, who was struck at the flashing pedestrian crosswalk near Davy Circle, was the third pedestrian in Chapel Hill to be struck by a vehicle that week, according to data on pedestrian automobile collisions kept by the NCDOT. There were 17 such collisions in 2020. 17, and that number increased to 29 in 2021, 27 in 22, and 33 in last year, 2023. The rate of pedestrian deaths is increasing nationwide, and DOT data shows that North Carolina is no exception to that trend. The issue is particularly apparent in the Research Triangle. Pedestrian collisions occur in Chapel Hill, Raleigh, and Durham at rates higher than the state average, despite all three of those local governments having dedicated traffic safety programs committed to curbing preventable accidents. Achieving the goal of zero traffic fatalities has proven to be a challenge in the face of limited funds and the Triangle's booming population. In North Carolina, automobile pedestrian collisions increased from 1,932 in 2007 to 2,229 in 2022, although much of that increase can be explained by the state's population growth. In fact, the rate of crashes per 100,000 residents in 2007 was higher than it was in 2022. What's baffling community leaders and researchers alike is a more alarming trend. The rate of pedestrian deaths has been steadily increasing for at least the past decade and across the U.S. in North Carolina. Some experts have suggested that drivers are more distracted than ever by smartphones and touchscreen displays in cars, although a researcher, Stephen Heine, said there isn't great data to corroborate that explanation. Haney is a research associate at the UNC Highway Safety Research Center, which is headquartered on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, right in the middle of Chapel Hill. His work focuses primarily on pedestrian safety, and he says these fatalities are largely occurring on really one type of roadway. These are wider, multi-lane roads, and most of them are in more built-up areas. So urban suburban areas with lots of commercial residential development around them. That description fits many of the major roads in the Research Triangle that are seeing more and more traffic each year as people are lured to the area by a lucrative job market. Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh all experience pedestrian collisions at a higher rate than the state average. While there's no discernible trend regarding pedestrian deaths in Chapel Hill and Durham, fatalities are rapidly increasing in the state capital. There were 23 pedestrian deaths in Raleigh in 2022. That's a 64% increase compared to the previous high of 14 deaths in 2019. Now, Chapel Hill is a Vision Zero community, meaning that the town decided to join a global network of municipalities across Europe and the United States committed to eliminating traffic deaths and serious injuries. The basic philosophy of the Vision Zero network is that traffic deaths are a systemic problem, not a behavioral one, and that road infrastructure and related policies should be designed to expect human error and therefore lessen the severity of crashes. The Chapel Hill Town Council pledged to eliminate traffic deaths and serious injuries within a decade in its 2021 Vision Zero resolution, which evolved from an earlier version of a traffic safety program that the town adopted in 2018. Chapel Hill is one of 18 communities in North Carolina, including Raleigh and Durham, that have begun implementing Vision Zero strategies. Bergen Watterson, the Mobility and Greenways Manager of the Chapel Hill Planning Division, leads the town's Vision Zero efforts. She said one of the main goals of the program is creating more traffic calming measures, saying, if you're driving 25 miles an hour, you have a way less likely chance of killing somebody than you do if you're even driving 35. Watterson and Henry both emphasize that multi-lane roads with wide lanes are particularly problematic because they can make drivers feel more comfortable driving at high speeds. Watterson said Chapel Hill has taken several steps over the past several years to slow cars down on heavily trafficked roads. Some of these efforts include changing the speed limits on all locally owned roads to 25 miles an hour, installing rectangular rapid flashing beacons, commonly known as RRFB, at mid-block crosswalks on MLK Boulevard and Franklin Street, and erecting bollards between lanes in sections of MLK. Sean Driscoll is the program manager for Raleigh's Vision Zero program, which was adopted in 2022. He said his team is looking into another low-cost, high-impact solution. That's an unfortunate designation. Low-cost, high-impact solution to lessen the severity of pedestrian automobile collisions. And Daskell says, we're still averaging 30 to 40% of our fatalities a year, unfortunately, being pedestrians. So for my group, that's why there's an approach to target those individuals around schools, around downtown areas, just overall around locations where we know there's high pedestrian traffic. Driscoll said the city improved the signage around school zones and is also looking into installing raised crosswalks in its efforts to slow drivers down. The city of Durham, which became one of the first North Carolina communities to pass a Vision Zero resolution in 2017, did not respond to a request for an interview about its program. Representatives of Chapel Hill and Raleigh said they were optimistic about their respective pedestrian safety efforts, although both their Vision Zero programs are in the early stages of implementation. Right now, it's too early to tell from the data whether the initiatives are creating positive change. Both Haney and Driscoll said continued funding and buy-in from their local and state governments will be necessary to see their goals through. Chapel Hill allots $50,000 of its yearly budget to Vision Zero and an additional $75,000 for bicycle and pedestrian safety. In its most recent budget, Raleigh set aside $3.2 million for maintenance, traffic signals, and Vision Zero. Still, that's just enough money for smaller projects and necessary maintenance. The programs rely on grants from the Department of Transportation and the Governor's Highway Safety Association for any more ambitious undertakings. At least for right now, the progress on Vision Zero initiatives across the Triangle have been slow-moving. So slow-moving that many residents likely don't know that Vision Zero exists. Some say they haven't noticed much change in terms of pedestrian safety at all. Watterson says, I don't know that we've gotten a ton of community feedback on Vision Zero. In fact, I'd probably say the majority of the community doesn't know what it is. We're working to change that. Larson, who hadn't heard of Chapel Hill's Vision Zero program, still walks her beloved Australian Shepherd daily. The collision that nearly took her life occurred on RRFB. Proof that even the pedestrian-friendly infrastructures that some municipalities are choosing to build aren't perfect. Larson said she'd prefer stoplights at some of the mid-block crossings with RRFBs, saying, I don't know if necessarily I would say I see the infrastructure being set up for pedestrian safety, but hopefully that's something town leaders work on at the future. For now, Larson said she and the Jasper will continue to avoid that crosswalk near Davy Circle. All right, now we have three consecutive articles all headquartered or specifying Durham or Durham County. First, the Durham Council, City Council, weighs whether to continue with the shot spotter. After a year-long trial of this controversial program ended in December, many Durham residents assumed the gunshot detection technology was a thing of the past. But on Thursday, it was back with a bang on the Durham City Council agenda. Council members discussed authorizing a $650,000 three-year contract to continue using the ShotSpotter gunshot detection service. It is a technology that uses acoustic sensors to detect and locate gunshots and notify and dispatch police immediately. According to the company, less than 20% of gunfire events are reported to 911 nationally. And even when reported, emergency calls often come several minutes after the incident. During the one-year-long experiment in Durham, from December 22 to 23, ShotSpotter was deployed in a 3-square-mile area. That's a small but high-risk region that accounts for nearly a third of Durham's gunshot wound incidents. At Thursday's council work session, the Wilson Center for Science and Justice, that's at Duke University School of Law, presented an independent evaluation of ShotSpotter. They found that in this pilot area, police response times improved by 1.2 minutes, and the technology helped police find evidence in 71 cases and led to 7 arrests. It is unclear whether ShotSpotter helped reduce gun violence overall, and questions of accuracy remain. According to Durham's fourth quarter crime report, also presented at this work session, Durham saw an 11% increase in the number of shootings between 2022 and 23, including 79 incidents where 911 was not called, but ShotSpotter detected gunfire. Yet the program has attracted considerable controversy. At previous council meetings, Durham residents have voiced concerns about increased surveillance in vulnerable communities. The Wilson Center found that ShotSpotter led to 2.3 extra police deployments daily in that pilot area, utilizing patrol resources that could have gone elsewhere. In December, when City Council voted against extending the pilot for 3 more months, some argued that funds should be redirected to loose solutions addressing gun violence at the root. Abdul Nasser Rad, managing director at Campaign Zero, a police reform campaign, zoomed into Tuesday's meeting to voice his concerns. He referenced Chicago's recent decision to terminate its contract with ShotSpotter citing fears of over-policing in black and brown communities. Council member Mark Anthony Middleton responded to Nasser's concerns by listing other cities, including San Francisco, New York City, six cities in this state, and more where ShotSpotter programs are regarded as successful. Mayor Leonardo Williams said, "That's Chicago, and this is Durham. I want to focus on Durham and allowing the data to help us make this decision." Some Durham residents are avid ShotSpotter supporters. John Tay Dunstan said he took time off of work to verbalize his frustration at discontinuation of the program, and he said, "In the communities that ShotSpotter is set up in, these are communities where no one calls 911. If you hear a shot, everybody goes on with their business. The community is so confused, and we're angry at the council." Dunstan said, continuing to speak long after Williams cut him off. Williams said he wants the council to dig deep into the data before making an informed, objective decision, and the council is expected to vote on this motion to bring back ShotSpotter at the next city council meeting that's coming up on March the 4th. Next, we'll go to the Durham School Board and this incident with the raises for school employees, which had been cut back and then restored. Classified workers in Durham Public Schools will receive a flat 11% raise over their last year's compensation for the rest of the school year, the Board of Education decided on Thursday. The vote came at 11:30 p.m., 5 hours into the much-anticipated and emotional meeting. It passed 5-2, with Emily Chavez and Alexandra Valladares voting no. While workers will make more money than they did last year, many at the meeting were deeply unhappy with the decision. That's because, for many workers, paychecks for the remainder of the year will shrink compared to what they received in October through February. Occupational therapist Leslie Riley said before the vote, "I drive 20 minutes north to work for a DPS school, but I could drive 20 minutes south and make $10,000 more." The 11% raise was one of two options proposed by independent comptroller Carrie Crutchfield, who was contracted recently to examine the district's finances. The other option was a flat 15% raise. According to Crutchfield's presentation, which he had 3 weeks to pull together, the 11% raise was the most the district could afford to pay within the current budget. The decision came at a packed meeting on the heels of a tumultuous 6 weeks, many of which were covered by the Indy and other newspapers for quite a while. The grass around the property served as a secondary parking lot after the first one filled. People lined the walls of the room after all the seats were taken. Body heat became a significant issue. Board member Giovanna Lewis fanned herself with a plastic folder as she listened to Crutchfield speak. In October, the district gave raises to nearly 2,000 non-certified workers, cafeteria, instructional assistants, therapists, and more. But after giving the raises, the district discovered that the new pay rates would put the district at least $9 million over budget. At first, DPS administration announced they would retract the raises. But after the news prompted sick-outs, protests, and school closures, the system continued to pay the raised rates through February, while the school board struggled to figure out a longer-term solution. The superintendent resigned earlier this month over the pay dispute. Board member Alexandra Valladares said last night, "This is a train wreck." Before hearing Crutchfield's report, the board heard public comment from attendees. Having already seen the options online, many workers jumped to express their disappointment. One worker said, "These are the same reheated options. Either options will cut my salary significantly. I don't want to lose any of our very experienced staff to other districts," said board member Jessica Carda-Outen. Board member Emily Chavez inquired about possible funding sources for continuing to pay the higher rates through the end of the year. "I just feel like we should pay them what we told them we would pay," she said. "That's what we came here tonight to hear," someone in the crowd whispered. Pulling from the school system's fund balance and a recent $18 million grant from philanthropist Mackenzie Scott were both mentioned as options. But pulling money from other sections of the budget is not as simple as it sounds, several system leaders said. The acting chief financial officer, Sierra Ojijo, told the board that the 11% raise was the only option within the budget reconciled the way it currently is. "Even if the money is there, rearranging it would be a much larger conversation," said acting superintendent Kathy Moore. Crutchfield, Moore, and board chair Bettina Olmsted also reminded the board that salaries are recurring expenses, not one-time payments. They urged the board not to fund salaries with temporary funds, grants, or other monies that expire. Crutchfield, a man with fluffy white hair and a readily available smile, said continuing to pay workers at the higher rates would cost roughly $1 million per month over the budget. He also alluded to tight funding for education across the state of North Carolina, joking, "Don't get me started about the equity of state funding. You'll be here all night." Another option would be to ask the county commissioners for money. The board was scheduled to meet with commissioners on Monday, but postponed that meeting until March. Olmsted explained the board hadn't yet discussed its budget priorities for the next year, which is what the meeting is supposed to be about. Though board members bounced around other ideas, for example, Moore said that rescinding a 7% raise granted to administrators in October is, quote, on the table, nothing within immediate reach seemed to offer a solution. Olmsted said before casting her eye, quote, "It's been 6 weeks since we've been in this turmoil. I don't love every single option today." But she said of this 11% option, "It allows us to stay in budget. What's vital for us to consider is what happens now that is sustainable, that we can continue to increase our employees' salaries for the future." As the debate came to a close, Crutchfield shifted his gaze toward the future. The next agenda item was to discuss budget priorities for next year. That's the subject of next month's meeting, that is to say this month, with the county commissioners. Crutchfield signaled the board has more tough financial choices to come. The school district faces financial cliffs ahead because of federal funds that will soon expire. Crutchfield said, referring to the coming budget, "As difficult and as important as the decision you're making right now, the next agenda item is actually going to be more difficult. You're faced with a double whammy." After the vote, crowds of workers trudged toward their cars. Though the last 6 weeks have been fiery, last night many seemed more sad than mad. "I hope you're doing relatively okay, despite everything," one worker said to the man next to her on their way out. He mustered a half-hearted smile. "I'm trying," he responded. The actually longest by far article in this week's Indie Week is another Durham article based on Groove Wagon. Groove Wagon cans are bright and eye-catching, with the important figures spelled out. The amount of Delta 8 each THC beverage contains, its caloric content, and the phone number of the company co-owners, Riley Dunn and Sasha Klimchak. The couple, who don't have social media for the product, prefer to do business this way, directly, over text. "Sure, it might seem like a gimmick," said Dunn. Rightly done. One November evening over coffee, but Groove Wagon is a homegrown, quote, mom and pop operation, and the number really is theirs. To illustrate, he holds a beat-up iPhone with a glittery pink case. This number was how Parag Bhandari, the CEO of the marketing and events company UG Strategies, first reached out to them last May. Big fan of your products. Bhandari, who lives in Fuquay-Varina, wrote, I wanted to reach out to someone about events in North Carolina. Bhandari explained he was the founder of Bull City Summit, a, quote, music, art, science, and technology festival, planning its second year. He told Dunn and Klimchak that he thought Groove Wagon would be a perfect fit for event sponsorship at the next summit, scheduled for September 18 through 24 of last year. The summit, as Bhandari described it, was dynamic and polished with a draw like SXSW. Events would take place all over downtown Durham at venues like Motorcore, The Fruit, The Pinhook, and The Armory. There would be fireside chats, VIP lounges, happy hours, concerts, and community events, alongside keynote speeches from prominent thought leaders. There would be an NFT of a, quote, key to the city. It seemed promising, but within a month, the relationship between the two companies soured, and venues and vendors distanced themselves from this summit. Groove Wagon accused the Bhandari of financial fraud amounting to $18,000 in unfulfilled services and filed a charge of obtaining property by false pretense with the Durham Police, a Class H felony in North Carolina. On December 29th, Fuquay Police arrested Bhandari and released him on unsecured bond that night. In reporting this story, the Indy reviewed court documents, emails, texts, recordings, and contracts regarding the summit and spoke with more than 20 local business owners, artists, and former contractors and employees who have worked for UG Strategies or as contractors for other events. Many did not want to speak on the record, citing fear of litigation and retribution. In the beginning, though, Dunn and Klimchak, who live in Raleigh and have four children, were excited by the partnership. While they described their core audience for Groove Wagon, founded in 2020, as dads, dogs, and banjos, THC drinks are an adventurous market, and they'd recently sold their drinks at Hopscotch and Dreamville, even selling out of beverages at the latter event. Festivals seemed like a solid path for growth. Bhandari sent the couple a link to the UG Strategies website. UG stands for Underground. Skeletal but polished, that greets visitors with an assurance. We work with the world's most famous brands. Dunn says he had no social media, but I didn't view it as suspicious because we don't have social media. So my dumb ass is like, this is cool as anything. Of course there's no real evidence of any of this work he's done because he's underground. Bhandari and Groove Wagon drew up plans for promotional events across the state, including this summit. He told them he envisioned even greater things for the young company, and he would like to see it that Groove Wagon got into festivals like Bonnaroo, Sundance, and Coachella. You guys are Red Bull, Klimchak recalls Bhandari telling them very often. You guys are going to be so big. Festivals are a difficult business, one that generally requires specific personalities, galaxy-brained, charismatic, determined to hold them. Bhandari, a 45-year-old raised in New Jersey, fits this description, animated and imaginative across various interviews on podcasts and videos. He seems quick to see potential in branding opportunities, weaving enthusiastic connections between ideas. According to his LinkedIn profile, Bhandari has been the CEO of UG Strategies since 2003. The website lists offices in Los Angeles, New York, and Durham, and clients ranging from University Studios and JetBlue to HBO and Armani Exchange. Over the years, Bhandari has produced events and business through UG strategies, but says that he wanted to start fresh with Bull City Summit, LLC, which is what he is producing the event through. According to the North Carolina Secretary of State website, UG Strategy's Certificate of Authority to Do Business was revoked, effective May 16th of 2023. Bhandari came to North Carolina in 2018 when the popular electronic festival Moog Fest, then newly relocated from Asheville to Durham, was in the throes of management troubles. Moog Music granted Bhandari the license to that festival, which he then administered. It proved successful. Headlined by artists like Kalela and Yves Tumor, it created $7 million in economic impact for Durham and received a glowing recap from the online music magazine Consequence of Sound, calling it, quote, a festival to remember. It would be one of the last Moog Fests to remember, several months after Moog Music terminated Bhandari's festival licensing. The following year, that festival, run by a different CEO, became the final event. Soon after, UGS sued Moog Music, claiming the festival was in breach of its three-year contract. Pitchfork reported in September of 2021 that UGS sought damages in excess of $25,000, a relatively low figure, but one that Bhandari told vendors allowed him to finance Bull City Summit. According to records from the Wake County Superior Court, the case was dismissed. Bhandari says he's legally restrained from discussing the settlement. Festivals, for all their complications, can be game changers for mid-sized cities. In 2023, Hopscotch brought 25,000 attendees to downtown Raleigh and generated about $3 million for the local economy. J. Cole's High Voltage Dreamville drew an audience four times that size and left an economic footprint of almost $8 million. Durham's full-frame documentary festival has brought consistent international prestige since 1998, in addition to economic impact, $3.7 million in 2019, that last year the film festival was held, and it's slated to return this April. The city also had a solid seven-year run with The Art of Cool, a festival shining light on local black music that held its last event back in 2019. Durham Bottling Company owner Nick Jordan says, reflecting on the need for more downtown events, a rising tide does lift all boats. That's why we all want a festival in Durham. By the time live events began to return post-pandemic, downtown business was sluggish and Durham was in a festival deficit. Bhandari had been involved in a few successful downtown events, like a series of pandemic-era outdoor concerts in the parking lot, formerly adjoining Motor Co., and had his sights on an ambitious new event to fill the gap. Depending on how you feel about the promise of things like cryptocurrency and AI, the tenor of proposed Bull City Summit events might seem like an odd fit for Durham, a city more commonly associated with pride parades and the performing arts. But the city's demographics are also rapidly changing with an influx of tech companies and a new upper middle class, and Bhandari seemed to feel there was solid ground for a new venture. The first summit, originally planned for March of 22, was postponed to that September and scaled down when the timeline proved tight. In an interview, Bhandari described it as a pilot. He said one contractor for that 22 summit, who asked to remain anonymous, fearing litigation and retribution, says, I didn't realize what a debacle enacting BCS was going to be until I was in too deep. Little of the important details were organized. Things were missed, overlooked, or changed often. He wanted basically 18 months of work to come together in 6 weeks. Jeremy Barber, a videographer hired to shoot and edit videos for the 22 Summit, said the first year was bumpy and seemed disconnected from the community. Quote, lack of management and lack of communication appeared, to my eyes, to be rampant. The turnout was also low. And Barber continued, like 75% of the seats were empty easily. There would be a band playing to a room of their girlfriends, and that's it, with nobody from the festival except for us. But Bhandari seemed confident enough in the summit's vision to pursue another year. He wrote in a press release last year, Durham, North Carolina is a visionary hotbed of creativity, and we're proud to share our diverse, purpose-led programming with the community and abroad. The 23 Summit seemed off to a good start, with $13,000 in grant funding from the City of Durham, routed through the Summit's fiscal sponsor, that was the local nonprofit Families and Community Rising. It was one of the 15 cultural events the city supported through grants. In most fiscal sponsorships, a nonprofit lends its tax-exempt status to a project related to its mission. Established in 1969, Families and Community Rising, that's FCR, states its mission is, quote, to educate and empower children, families, communities, and organizations by delivering unique educational and supportive services. It's unclear what FCR saw as the mission-related benefit of partnering with Bull City Summit, but the nonprofit covered festival costs, including some contractor and artist payments, and contributed a day of community programming featuring local artists and food trucks. By the end of the summit, that nonprofit, which did not have a contract or MOU in place ahead of the event, had spent around $80,000 on the summit, according to Bhandari. In conversation with Indy, Bhandari said that FCR did not want a contract and was content with the arrangement. He says, it was always about, we've got a budget and we can help. We're going to do this together and take care of bills that are related to the festival, with the understanding that BCS is going to create corporate funding programs for FCR. Bhandari told Indy that he had fundraised about $30,000 in sponsorship, ticket revenue from Moto Code door sales, silent auction, and the city grant for the nonprofit, and had plans to raise more. He told Indy, I want to go into 2024 raising $100,000 for them. FCR seemed to have a different understanding of events. When Indy reached out to the nonprofit CEO, Terry David, with quotes from Bhandari and a request for comment, David contested Bhandari's characterization of the relationship. He wrote, what Parag is not saying is FCR expenses for BCS were over $100,000, and FCR was not reimbursed for those expenses. He's adding that the nonprofit is considering legal options, up to and including litigation. Bhandari says FCR declined to be involved in the 2024 summit, but the local nonprofit, the Triangle Blues Society, is on board to be the fiscal sponsor. Attempts to reach the Triangle Blues Society for comment were not successful. Meanwhile, Bhandari says that while FCR has declined future fiscal sponsorship, he has plans to generate, quote, additional value that their CEO is well aware of and is welcoming. David wrote, FCR has no plans for a continued relationship with BCS or Parag. In the months leading up to the summit, Groove Wagon was also experiencing troubles. And were, they say, losing money on projects with Bhandari. He'd told them that Elements, a three-day EDM festival in Pennsylvania, wanted 24,000 cans, a large figure, given that 18,000 people reportedly attended the festival. Dunn says, from the beginning, I was very skeptical about how large an amount of orders that was. I was like, nobody knows who we are up there. This is an entirely new product category that sounds kind of crazy. Are you sure? And over, he'd be like, if anything, I'm concerned we're not going to have enough. A fraction of the cans sold. Groove Wagon says they ended up with around $6,000 in the hole, an amount they still owe Elements. The couple also alleged they had wired Bhandari $31,500 for tents, banners, and other merchandise from Telepathic Graphics, a local design company that worked with UGS. But months later, Telepathic Graphics sent an invoice saying that Bhandari had told them Groove Wagon was paying directly. The companies are still disputing the payment. The Indie reviewed an email from Bhandari in which he states the materials cost $31,500 and asks Groove Wagon to wire him that amount, as well as two deposits the couple made earmarked Elements. Bhandari denies receiving money specific to the merchandise from Groove Wagon. When reached for comment, Telepathic Graphics owner Bob Boyle declined to say much beyond stating he's always had a positive experience with Bhandari. "No comment," he said, "except I want someone to put on their big boy pants and pay me." Dunn says there is an element that is just moving from one to the next, shuffle money around for a long time, keep people involved. Contractors who worked with Bhandari on past events also cited a track record of the entrepreneur not paying bills. Matt LaScala was hired by Bhandari as a contractor a few times, including one occasion when he was hired to organize Bhandari's tax documents after the Bull City Summit in 2022, and shortly thereafter when he was hired to work as event staff at the Fortnite Championship Series at Raleigh Convention Center. LaScala cited concerns about unpaid bills for things like contractors, storage rentals, and says that while organizing tax documents, he found, quote, bills and invoices and organized them into which expenses he still had to take care of, believing his answers when I ran each invoice by him and he told me which were paid, resolved, or expired. I presented him with a small pile that he definitely needed to take care of to avoid small claims court and traffic court. LaScala says he thanked me genuinely, tore them up, and threw them away. LaScala says he also still has a $1,000 outstanding invoice from working that Fortnite event. Bhandari denies ignoring invoices, tearing up bills, and owing money. "That's just not true," he says. "He was paid for his services and his work. I have the invoices and the payments, and if there's an additional amount that's in dispute, I have the right to dispute that, right? If he didn't do what I think he should have done, or vice versa?" Ryan Snyder worked for Moogfest for several years as a photographer and a staff member. In the summer of 2018, he was hired by Bhandari through UG Strategies as an editorial manager. In August of that summer, Moog Music pulled Bhandari's license to run the festival. Snyder says, "He paid me up until the day he was no longer managing the festival. However, he left me hanging without the severance I was owed in the amount of $4,000. Bhandari says he isn't sure about the severance and suggested payments he could not make were the responsibility of Moog Music. "If there was a payment that was not made, we may not have been able to pay it based on the fact we didn't get the funds from Moog. It's not like we got paid everything and just didn't pay invoices. With Moogfest, if there's $4,000, compare that to the $2 million of invoices we did pay." Sean Thiegan, who worked for Bhandari as a contractor for Moogfest in 2018, says he also has an unpaid invoice for UG Strategies. "I was told Moog should be paying it, but that's the only explanation I ever received, despite all my other invoices pre-festival being paid by UG Strategies." Bhandari said, "I have no comment to this. These are invoices from 5 years ago that I do not have." Many people who worked with the summit or from Bhandari on other events were reluctant to speak on the record. Conversations with dozens of sources began and ended the same way. They wanted to talk, but worried about legal or reputational risk. Bhandari says those characterizations of him are false. He says, "I hate litigation. I don't seek it. I don't want it. You know, I just love Durham and want to do my best here." With Harvey Mason Jr., CEO of the Recording Academy, as a headliner, and performances from Lee Fields and Death from Above, 1979, the Bull City Summit of 23 promised, quote, a mammoth gathering of minds in music, arts, science, and technology. Events included topics like new crypto bull market and synergy between personal branding and the visual arts industry. By this point, Dunn and Klimchuk say they were still holding out hope the hometown exposure might justify the expenses they'd already shelled out. Of their appearances at the festival, the couple says they had three summit events scheduled, one at Motorco, another at Fruit, and another at Luella. Bhandari told the Indy, if they're telling you that certain amounts of money were to go to certain venues, that's completely false. Indy, however, reviewed correspondence between Bhandari and Groovewagon confirming logistics for the three events, as well as a recording in which Bhandari said he had spent $32,000 on Groovewagon sponsorship for the festival, including $13,000 Motorco, $3,000 Fruit, and $2,500 on Luella. The events didn't happen. When Groovewagon employees showed up at Motorco and the Fruit with a stash of drinks, venue owners told them they had no knowledge of the arrangement and turned them away. Bhandari canceled the brunch event at Luella, an indoor venue, citing rain. When Dunn emailed Bhandari to ask how the $32,000 was deployed, Bhandari replied, it is not upon you. No, it is not upon you, nor is it in our sponsorship contract to dictate how our sponsorship funds are used. You do not have auditing rights. Some events did draw a sizable crowd, like Motorco's Saturday evening concert from the Canadian duo Death from Above, 1979. When Indy reached out to the band's manager and asked for a comment, he replied, it doesn't benefit me or my artist to comment on my experience that day, but added, this email doesn't surprise me. Indy also reached out to several local musicians who performed at the event. While a few provided background info, none were willing to go on the record, citing reputational concerns. Former festival employees also declined to speak at length on the record, including Tess Magnum of Sonic Pie Productions, an experienced local producer who abruptly quit working with UGS last summer. I, Sonic Pie Productions, will not work with Bull City Summit again, Mangum wrote. Some cited more mundane concerns like low attendance or poor promotion of events. Tim Walter, owner of The Fruit, said that while attendance was below expectations, he is sympathetic to any producer who is persevering during these slow times and is holding dates open for the 24 summit. A series of daytime talks at the co-working space Durham Bottling Company was well attended. Nick Jordan says, although he was surprised when an employee of Families and Community Rising showed up and asked for $5,000, saying Bhandari had told the nonprofit the company was a festival sponsor. Jordan said no. He was already letting UGS use the space free of charge, and the issue was dropped. Jordan says he is undecided about participating in the 2024 event. Dirty Bull owner Matt Panisi says following its experience with the event in 23, the brewery does not plan to work with the summit again, saying in an email, they were supposed to have one event at Dirty Bull, but didn't promote it and no one showed up for it. Another event they actually never scheduled with us, but they promoted. No one actually showed up for that either. Co-owner of Motorco, Jeremy Roth, says Motorco is no longer involved with Bull City Summit, declining to say more on the record. Luella owner Cam Davis also said he does not plan to work with Bull City in the future, and adds that he has worked with Groovewagon since the company launched and was upset about its experience with Bhandari. Davis says, I've enjoyed doing business with them and selling their product. It's great to have a product like that from good people. For them to be affected is very unfair. The Pinhook is not also participating again. Owner Kim Register says, I want something that calls itself Bull City anything, especially Bull City Summit, to really have the values of our community intact and communication with people and cultural workers and artist venues that reflects how the Durham that I know has held space for that culture and art that creates a big part of the vibrance of the city. After the 23 summit drew to a close, Dunn and Klimchak began talking to people across town who had been involved in it. Throughout their sponsorship, they say, Bhandari had a habit of keeping communication siloed between various employees and vendors, often telling them that other people were untrustworthy, an allegation that Bhandari denies. They soon learned they were not the only people who had issues with Bhandari. Dunn said, there's just enough legitimacy. I bet the killer bands are getting paid. But then there's also this element of, like, what's real and what isn't? Because some of it is real. Sensing a pattern, Dunn and Klimchak decided to pursue fraud charges in the hope of regaining some funds and making other local businesses aware of their experience. Fuquay police arrested Bhandari on December 29 and released him that night. An unsecured bond. Cute. Get ready, Bhandari texted Dunn and Klimchak the next morning after he learned who was behind the charge. You have no idea who you are dealing with. That may have been true at the start of the relationship, but Dunn and Klimchak says they now have a clearer picture of the entrepreneur. One night after the summit, for example, the couple's nanny, outraged on behalf of her employees, sat down with an Excel spreadsheet and a bottle of wine and began Googling Bhandari's various enterprises. Search results pulled up civil lawsuits against UGS in New York, a photographer alleging copyright infringement, another pending case from a capital fund, as well as a lawsuit against Euphoric, a streaming service, described by Bhandari in a press release as, quote, ESPN for festivals that Bhandari had co-founded. Reflecting on their experiences across hours of interviews, sources expressed conflict about how to quantify their experience with UG and Bull City Summit. Many say they believe that Bhandari was committed to executing his vision for a creative festival experience in Durham. Maybe a bad experience was just the product of someone who wasn't very good at writing checks and signing contracts, a dreamer who'd bitten off more than they could chew. Riley Dunn, though, believes the situation is more straightforward. Quote, I do think he specifically preyed on us. I think he chooses artists and people who he knows won't fight back, or people who he thinks he can bully into not talking to other people. Dunn and Klimchak said they have fallen behind on mortgage payments as they try to recover lost costs and continue to run their business. They're also gearing up for a district court hearing, which might have happened a couple days ago, February 28th. Bhandari wrote in an email to the Indy, at the end of the day, I'm proud of the work that I do and the money that I spend in this town and the relationships I am building for this town, which is my home. Finally, the third annual Bull City Summit is planned for November 12 to 17, and the Durham Cultural Advisory Board has recommended that the city allocate another $13,000 to support it. Early bird badges, according to the website, include, quote, exclusive discounts on concert pre-sales, VIP ticket upgrades, exclusive BCS artist experiences, and more. Tickets start at $99. And the only addition to this article is just to notice that this is disclosure. Both Groove Wagon and Bull City Summit have been Indy advertising partners. Two articles further to read, and there is not enough time to read either one of them in full, so I'll give a little précis of this one and save it. The indoor climbing industry is booming, but the transition to indoor climbing has changed the sport. And in the climbing industry, and you know, that's the ones with the climbing walls and the little hooks and things that people and young people alike go to. And then there's the climbing one where you go up the edge of a mountain somewhere. Of all people, it was a jiu-jitsu partner who asked Bryce Mahoney if he wanted to go to an indoor climbing excursion to Pilot Mountain. Sure, why not? It required him to trust his friend's expertise that everything was safe, but at the time he didn't know how much peace and restoration the activity would bring him. He didn't know how much it would click being so high up off the ground. That's all I will read on that one, and I'm going to put that again in my packet for future consideration, and then a review of a new hot new bar, which is mostly related to dry January month, and February just ended, so who knows about that one. It's the Umbrella Dry Bar on Martin Street in Raleigh. I decided to attempt Dry January after a particularly tipsy Christmas Day when I was tasked with helping a much drunker friend home to bed. Anyone who has ever partied a little too hard has likely sworn off alcohol at least once, but it was witnessing the swaying of my friend that incentivized me to forego for the first month of the new year. Well, where to go? I'm going to just cut to the chase here. The purpose of Umbrella Dry Bar is to ease the transition to dry non-alcoholic drinks, making it easier for people who don't want to drink to say no, says this fellow, Meg Paradise, this woman, founder and co-owner of Umbrella. The bar, which opened in early January on West Martin Street, kicked off with an alcohol-free New Year's Eve party. A few weeks later, the bar still has a steady trickle of customers early on a Friday night. As with traditional bars, the foot traffic picks up later in the evening, says Meg Paradise. The cozy, dimly lit space attracts people bar-hopping downtown. Once inside, it's hard to distinguish it from your run-of-the-mill alcohol establishment. Bottles of non-alcoholic spirits line up on shelves behind the bar, the perfect place to chat with the bartender or meet some friends. Across the room, booths offer a lovely haven to have a quiet conversation under low lights. My drink of choice, the cleverly titled Matcha Do About Nothing, looks like a typical cocktail and is strong enough to sip on. As I savor an earthy, vanilla-flavored drink, it's surprisingly easy to relax into a frank conversation, the kind you have with your friends at 2 a.m. after most of the party guests have left. And I have to cut off my broadcast of Indie Week this week. All the articles that I've read to you and some more are available at IndieWeek.com as an online service of this publication. John Feddersen now will say farewell to you from the North Carolina Reading Service with Indie Week. Happy March, everybody.